Today on Backroom Politics, immigration reform takes front center stage here in Washington, D.C. Also, we're going to talk about the impending confirmation or not confirmation of former Senator Chuck Hagel for Secretary of Defense. We'll talk about the Hillary hearings and her departure as Secretary of State and that wonderful love fest on 60 Minutes. We're also going to talk about the GOP turnaround on the debt limit. Oh, by the way, they found common sense. This and Tell Me a Story today on Backroom Politics.
Live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., this is Backroom Politics with your moderator, Justin Russell. To join the political discussion today, you can call toll-free at 877-662-3713. And now, with the roundtable, your moderator, Justin Russell.
Backroom Politics on Blog Talk Radio, live from Shelley's Backroom in Washington, D.C. We'll go around and introduce the roundtable as we begin our weekly political discussion of all things politics in D.C. and outside the Beltway. Joining me to my left, as he does every Tuesday, he is the former 8-term member of Congress representing Washington's 2nd Congressional District. He is Congressman Al Swift. Hi.
Hello. How are you?
What are you doing with your hands? What are you doing?
Well, I just squeezed a lime into my soda water, and it got all over my fingers.
It's a lime. It's supposed to do that. They're juicy that way.
Well, can I wipe them off on your shirt?
You wouldn't be the first one to do that today. To his left, he is longtime Washington insider and former executive director of the Democratic Party of the great state of Maryland. He is Carl Tuvin. Hello, Carl.
It's nice to be here in this mild day in Washington.
It is mild. It is very warm. Strange weather patterns, strange political patterns happening. We'll talk about that in a second. To my 12 o'clock, as he is every Tuesday, he is the former floor chief for Gerald R. Ford. He is also the former vice president of government affairs for the National Broadcasting Corporation. He is Bob Hines. Hi, Bob.
Hey, Justin. Glad to be here. And Al, keep your slimy hands off my shirt.
Ew. And to his right, he is the former Undersecretary of Commerce under President Reagan. He is longtime Senate staffer, longtime Washington insider, and a very distinguished and handsome fellow from the Stimson Center. He is Alan Moore. Hi, Alan.
Hello, Justin. Hello, gentlemen.
Good to have you back. Hey, lots of stuff going on. We're going to start talking about breaking news. We're going to talk about breaking news coming out of Las Vegas, where President Obama has set the gauntlet down with the Republican compromise. The big talk around Washington, D.C. this week is immigration. The gang of eight for immigration that they're talking about, because, you know, anytime we hear a gang of eight, we know it's going to be effective, efficient politics. The gang of eight, a bipartisan measure coming out of the Senate, was discussed, and they talked about four key areas that Congress will address in immigration reform in the newest session of the 113th Congress. As a result of that, President Barack Obama, showing a little bit of bully pulpit action, goes to Las Vegas and addresses the immigration issue and says that he has his own proposal if, in fact, Congress can't come off the mark and move on immigration reform. First, let's talk about what is in the new Senate proposal for immigration reform. Basically, we're talking about a compromise between Democrats and Republicans that includes a path to citizenship for illegal aliens who are here unlawfully, as they put it. It creates a special segment for young children who were brought here as young children illegally. It also reforms the immigration system to reflect the current state of our economy, as one of the legislative pillars put it. It creates an effective employment verification system that will prevent identity theft and the hiring of future unauthorized workers. And finally, it establishes an improved process for admitting future workers to serve our nation's workforce while protecting American national workforce members. So, that being on the table, lots of stuff talking, and there's a lot of other nuances involved in that. Alan Moore, I'm going to start with you. When we talk about immigration, I mean, to find out that the Senate came out with a bipartisan approach, it included some very key Republicans and key Democrats on the issue. Were you surprised at the Gang of Eight coming with a definitive plan for immigration on this?
Well, I was surprised at the makeup of the gang because it's an impressive...
Well, talk about the makeup real quick.
It's an impressive group. You've got the two deputy Democratic leaders, Dick Durbin from Illinois and Chuck Schumer from New York, very, very senior guys, both of whom would love to be the next majority
and
leader of the Senate. And then you have Robert Menendez, the incoming chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, as soon as John Kerry becomes Secretary of State, and Michael Bennett from the state of Colorado, who is the new head of the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee. These are heavy hitters among the Democrats. And on the Republican side, you've got John McCain, who's been a leader on this and then backed away on this and is back now into the leadership role. Lindsey Graham from South Carolina, who's been his partner, the new hotshot heartthrob upcoming star Marco Rubio from Florida, the Cuban American who has staked out some territory but has joined this group. And Jeff Flake, the new senator from Arizona. So you got both senators from Arizona in the group. That's a really interesting group. Having said that, let's not overstate what they've got. This is important, but there's a long way from a four-page outline of principles to a legislative proposal. A great many pitfalls, a great many decisions that have to be made, any one of which could upset this. Just among this group of eight, not to mention the president, who out in Las Vegas today outlined a proposal of his own that's got a little bit different emphasis.
You dropped your cigar, Congressman Al. Congressman Al, when we look at the makeup of this Gang of Eight, again, going back to Alan's point, you've got four very key Democrats and four very key Republicans on this. How much backtracking was there on this by each of the parties? Or did the parties' leaderships in the Senate both come up and say, we're sticking to it, this is the way we're going to go, this has got to be bipartisan, and it's got to move forward?
Well, it's going to be very embarrassing for all eight of them if they can't work something out, just because they are important people, particularly on the Democratic side. But the Republican side are represented with leadership as well. So... clearly, those eight guys are serious. They don't want to fail, and they're going to be working it. I think the greatest enemy of getting something done this time is going to be if one side or the other or both start getting precious over details. You've got the basics laid out. At least they've said we're going to address what I think we would all agree are the basics. And if one side or the other starts nickel and diming it, or as my favorite chairman John Dingell used to say, get duck bit, you don't want to duck bite this thing to death.
But Bob Hines, let's be honest, you've seen legislation like this that comes out bipartisan, comes out pretty basic, pretty clean. This is going to get convoluted very quickly. Am I wrong in that?
I hope so. And I suspect that... given the amount of interest in both parties about getting something done here on immigration, and the fact that, as Alan says, and that some leadership on both sides of the aisle are involved, and I suspect without knowing that the official leadership of the party, Mr. Reid and McClellan and...
Mitch McConnell.
Mitch McConnell,
yeah.
Another one of my favorites.
Well, I would think that they both are aware and were aware of what was going on. I suspect that there will be hearings relatively quickly, and it will be, I think, something that I guess probably Mr. Menendez, who is the Foreign Affairs Chairman now, or will be as soon as Mr. Kerry is confirmed for the Secretary of State. He's going to be holding those hearings, I think, probably pretty soon.
Alan, you're shaking your head no.
Yeah, I think it's going to be in Judiciary.
Judiciary?
Yeah.
You think so?
Yeah, and Chuck Schumer is the chairman of the Subcommittee on Immigration. I think that's what we'll see.
You're probably
hearings.
Right. Yeah.
There's another question on hearings, and do you have hearings of an oversight type, or do you wait for a bill to be drafted? Because they're a long way from having a piece of legislation, and the best hearings are on a particular piece of legislation,
but they can have
an oversight hearing if they want to.
That in itself is going to be the key focus of the debate. Is what we have right now from the gang of Immigration 8 is a proposal. What we don't know is what the language is going to look like in that bill. It's the bill process. It's the drafting and actually getting it into the hopper and onto the docket that is going to be a little dicey. Congressman Al?
Well, I would suggest that there's a step before which could give some indication as to whether this is going to be smoother or rougher, and that is, what do we get in terms of reaction to what the president said today? The Gang of Eight kind of presented its, and everybody said, that's interesting, and nobody attacked it. If they do the same thing with the president's, I think we're in a position to start to go. If there's a significant attack on the president's thing, then I think we may be back to ground warfare.
But Carl Toobin, there is no question that immigration is a top concern for the Obama White House in the second term incoming. The bottom line here is, I mean, when the president says in Las Vegas, and I quote, "Now is the time for comprehensive immigration reform," that's the president basically setting down the baseline, saying, "You guys are going to get this done." Did you just smoke my cigar again? No. Okay. Carl Toobin, what do you think?
Sleight of hand.
Sticky fingers.
Yeah. You know, the president campaigned on this. We have a good thing going on. Republicans and Democrats coming together to try to work this thing out. Maybe, just maybe, in the Senate, this portends a new thing, a new beginning. The big problem will be if it gets through the Senate, what's going to happen when it goes over to the House? And is the Tea Party, for one reason or another, going to hold this thing up and kill it?
But Bob Hines, you had a comment.
I would agree with Carl that it'll be interesting to see what the Tea Party people in the House and Senate say. We'll also think about all the interest groups that are involved in this kinds of things. You know, labor organizations, the business community. There's a whole lot of other groups out there that are going to be interested in this. And I think how they react will also have an impact on the way the Senate and the House maneuver.
But Bob, I mean, when we talk about immigration reform, I mean, there's a lot of aspects to this. But it seems, with the criminal justice side of it being one aspect of it, this is an economic call. This is something that we've created an economy that is solely based, largely in the service industry, those jobs that naturalized or regular Americans don't want to take. This is an economic issue, not so much a criminal justice issue. Is that accurate?
Well, I think certainly that is true. I mean, and particularly in the Southwest. It's very true in the agricultural world, obviously. And, again, that goes to a whole lot of organizations, as I said, from the unions to corporations that are involved in these questions and are going to have to live whatever the statute is. And I think that it'll be interesting to see how they react, whether it's with respect with inside hearings or whether they informally are communicating with Congress. I think we're going to hear probably very quickly in the next week or two, we're going to be beginning to hear what those organizations outside the Congress think about the proposals, not the bill, but there is no bill, but the proposals that are being suggested.
But Alan Moore, when we look at the Gang of Eight, one noticeable missing contingent from this was a member of the Texas delegation, which has been largely the front spear, along with Senator John McCain, in the border wars fight. Were you shocked that we didn't see somebody from Texas, from the Texas Senate delegation, on this Gang of Eight?
As you know, I'm pretty hard to shock. So,
what you're saying is you're jaded.
No, I wasn't shocked. I was more surprised at who was there, not concerned or worried about who wasn't there, because it's a pretty representative group. Having McCain back into the fold and having Rubio part of this, along with the group of Democrats we talked about, that surprised me. That's what gave me reason to hope. Not who's missing, but who was present. Now, as these guys have said, you know, the devil's in the details, and there are a lot of details, and we can talk or not talk about them, some of the tough issues that remain. But then this big question about the House and how does the House feel, and some of the comments coming out of the House is, hey, this is an amnesty program for illegals. That was something that a lot of us feel very strongly about, a lot of the public rejects, and are we going to change our mind totally about that? And the House is a big question mark in that regard.
And Congressman Allen, can the House get their arms wrapped around this? Especially, I mean, look, let's be honest. The Senate itself has been largely seen as dormant over the past few sessions.
Yes.
We're starting to see a new, invigorated, bipartisan Senate willing to work together. Can the House follow the lead of the Senate, or is this just a pipe dream?
Well, I think it should, for the Republicans' own political good. In fact, if I were the political leader of the House, I would go to the Tea Party people and say, shh, be very quiet. The liberals have got to have something to attack. And if you guys speak up, they will attack you. And you will probably lose in terms of public opinion. If you say nothing, they're likely to get out really left-wingy, and then we can go after them, and we win the battle.
Bob Mines.
Unfortunately, Al has touched on a very sensitive subject. Congressman Lamar Smith, former chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, came out vigorously in opposition to this proposal, this just, in effect, concept that the group of eight has got.
Did he mention one?
Yeah. He said it's amnesty.
And borders,
you know, border strength and amnesty. This is the position that the Tea Parties and the very conservative Republicans have taken for years. And unfortunately, it looks like one of the leaders of that group in the House is speaking out immediately on in a negative way upon the efforts of the great group of eight.
But we've also got a situation where we look into the weeds, into the proposal put up by the gang of immigration aid, as we're calling them. They talk about securing the border, about having a secure border and increasing surveillance capability on the borders. The reality, Alan Moore, is we've got a situation where the government's tried that. It was called SBINet, and they spent $1 billion with Boeing, and it turned out to be a massive failure. In this time of fiscal austerity, are they asking for the stars right now?
Well, this is one of the interesting questions in the Gang of Eight proposal. It says, before some of these new rights can be exercised, we have to be assured that the borders are secure and that enforcement is real. Well, we have spent well over $1 billion beefing up the borders. We have invested in just about every idea that anybody has. Now, you could spend twice as much money on the same stuff. We have done an enormous amount, and in terms of enforcement, we've beefed up the enforcement capabilities. How far do you go with that before you start then granting some of the new rights that are contingent upon this border enforcement, border control requirement? Don't know. Devil's in the details. So it's not like we haven't invested huge sums and done a lot and made a huge difference, prompting some experts to say we are now not in a net immigration issue with Mexico. It's stabilized. It's harder to get across. But there are some that are saying
that the stabilization of the influx of illegal immigrants coming in from Mexico isn't largely based on enhanced enforcement, it's based on the fact that our economy has been in the tank.
There's no question that there's a combination, as I just said. You know, some of it's the border activity, some of it's the economy up here, and some of it is the economy in Mexico, where there's some near the border enhanced and increased opportunities. But the point is, we're not seeing the flood for a combination of reasons that we used to have.
Congressman Al.
Alan may have the facts on this because my idea is sketchy, but it seems to me that a few years ago we tried to approach this problem by really toughening what happened to employers, U.S. employers, of illegal immigrants.
They invoked the E-Verify program.
And it seemed to me there was a strong negative reaction to that, and they kind of backed off. But that might be one of the cheapest and most effective ways to make it unattractive for Mexicans to come to our country.
Well,
Alan Moore.
Al makes the very good point that some of those employer sanctions are real. It's harder. People are more hesitant, especially established employers, as opposed to sort of the day laborer, the house cleaner types, the 2, 3, 5 employee person. And employer sanctions is an important part of the new proposal as well, to go back and require employers to jump through some different hoops to verify people's legality, their work history, and so on.
It basically puts more teeth in the E-Verify.
Well, presumably it does, but again, there's a lot of details that matter.
Yeah, but and
Congressman Al,
and my point was that needs to be done.
Yep.
If the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the NFIB and others don't back them off of it.
Bob Hines.
Interestingly enough, Al, I saw a short piece in one of the articles in the paper this morning. It indicated that both the AFL-CIO and the Chamber of Commerce are both in support of the concepts that they're hearing from the Gang of Eight.
And those are strange bedfellows on this issue.
Well, excuse me, I think I just saw an elephant fly.
Yeah. How about drones flying over the border?
Well, but go ahead, Adam Moore.
I was going to add a word. Actually, as I understand it, the AFL-CIO and the Chamber of Commerce have been deputized to work out a guest worker program, the details of a guest worker program, and that's mostly in the ag sector. It's mostly to do seasonal work that Americans have proven that they don't want to do and aren't willing to do. That's a progress in its own right. But then the question is, you deputize these guys, you say, work something out, bring it back to us, and that doesn't, there's no guarantee, though, that what they work out suddenly becomes acceptable. For example, suppose it has a huge price tag attached. Well, and people say, we like your idea, we don't have the $300 million that it would take to do it the way you want to do it. We got to go back and do it a different way.
But, you know, they've been talking about one of the other details in the weeds that they were talking about in this proposal is the control of those entering and exiting. It creates an exit visa program for the first time in the United States, which gets into a whole other situation. We're not only creating another layer of bureaucracy in this, we're creating another whole new funding source that, quite frankly, our budget can't handle. Congressman Al.
Well, one of the things that a lot of Americans have had a very hard time recognizing is that there is almost nothing the government can do about anything that isn't going to cost money. So you want this problem dealt with? How much are you willing to belly up with?
And we have to solve this problem. It is serious. It's a big difference.
At the risk of fiscal stability in the U.S.?
Yeah.
Really?
Well, look, if there's one way to maybe get the Democrats to be willing to, you know, spend work with the Republicans, and the Republicans being willing to work with the Democrats on raising some money, this may be one of the problems that they can both realize. They're going to have to find ways they don't like necessarily in their own pockets to settle this problem and solve it. It's got to be done.
But the reality still dictates, Carl, too, that you've got anti-spending Republicans of the Tea Party in the House. Democrats have been trying to push, whether you want to call it amnesty, immigration reform, knowing that there's a price tag associated with it. How are Democrats going to be able to sway those midline voters into saying, we've got to spend this money instead of spending on something else?
Well, you know, the president has made this a very high priority, and he will do a lot to get this done. And whether
define a lot, though,
I think he'll look into ways to get it done, whether it's cutting budgets or putting things on the table or whatever. He wants this done, and I think if he wants it done, he'll find a way to be able to get it done.
Alan Moore?
Yeah, a couple of thoughts. One, this is not going to fail because of a lack of money. We're not talking about billions and billions of dollars here, and we are talking about some significant benefits to the U.S. economy if we can sort this out. So this will not fall for money. This will fall either because the Republicans resist what is typically called amnesty. We're not going to reward illegal behavior, damn it, and we don't care who feels otherwise, is not going to happen, and they stop it that way. Or, yes, it's a priority of the president's, but the president's in an interesting position here because it's not impossible that he could get to a point where he wants the issue more than a solution. I'm not saying that's where he is, but he can overask, he can overreach, and he can be a hero of some and make it extremely difficult for Republicans to go along and then have to struggle with this issue again 2 years from now.
Bob Hines, Marco Rubio, a known Tea Party Republican in the Senate, freshman senator out of Florida, can he help bridge the tie between the Tea Party sector in the Senate, who are largely, from what we understand, amicable to this proposal, to those in the House who are probably going to have a stroke?
Well, as I said, Lamar Smith is already having one, former chairman of the Judiciary Committee. And there'll be others like that. But the fact of the matter is, I think Rubio's joining the group and becoming almost like a spokesman is going to be very, very helpful because, let's face it, I mean, Rubio is someone who likely has a bright future in the party. He's going to be a leader of Hispanics if hopefully they begin to move toward the Republican Party a little bit. So there's a lot of reasons to say that Rubio rolled the dice in one sense for in his own career. He thinks this is the way to go, and I think he's going to stay right there and work as hard as he can for it. And my guess is that's going to be probably as helpful as anything in getting it done.
Carl Toobin.
You know, as far as the finances are concerned, there's going to be taxes paid by these people who might not be paying taxes today. So you're going to have payroll taxes, Social Security taxes, and all kinds of other things paid. Also, you have to point out that 1 in 4 of foreign people or of people who have come from other countries are people who have gone into businesses and hired other people and created jobs. And this is a very important thing to look at for the future.
But, Alan Moore, when you look at Marco Rubio, when you look at John McCain, key Republicans on this Gang of Eight, when you look at Schumer from New York, Menendez from New Jersey, is this not so much an economic issue? Is this not so much a criminal justice issue? This is a political grab for the Hispanic electorate on both sides?
It's complicated. There's some of that. Clearly, there's politics involved. Clearly, when John McCain, who was in the forefront back under President George W. Bush, working with Ted Kennedy, was a major spokesperson and advocate for immigration reform in a big way. Then he backed away significantly when he was the candidate for president, has now returned. There are politics involved. Everybody saw what happened in the last election and how Hispanics completely and totally turned against Republicans. Yes, there's politics, but there's also policy and principle that's involved here that concerns people. Some issues are much easier to grab onto. The easiest one being the 2-year-old child who comes here with illegal parents, grows up in the system, speaks the language, only has known life in America, has worked, has gone to school here, and is vulnerable to being tossed. So there's policy and politics. There's both.
Congressman, our last word.
And to take your example and call it amnesty is ridiculous.
Well said.
Do we want to talk about what Joe Arpaio thinks? The sheriff out of Maricopa County, Arizona? No, probably not. He's against it. Shocker. Hey, when we come back, we're going to talk about the new fight, the huge media fight and the money fight on either confirming or not confirming former Senator Chuck Hagel as our new Secretary of Defense. This is Backroom Politics Live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 Ash Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. We'll be back in 2 minutes. Stay with us.
Wow, a little bit of Fats Waller, Lulu back in town, and I tell you, when I am back in town, or when any of my friends are back in town, or heck, when we're living here in town, we usually find ourselves down at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., right across from the National Press Club. Why do we come here? Well, they've got the city's best cigar menu. The most diversified, with some of the best-known brands and some that you might even know, but you might want to give it a try. Everything from Arturo Fuentes down to Zeno. You can go all the way from your $9 little petite girly flavored cigars all the way up to the Opus X Lost City. They have a cigar for everybody. Mild, medium, strong, heavy. However you want to smoke it, it's available here at Shelley's Back Room. Come in, have Bob, Na, or any one of the girls show you what the right cigar might be for your taste that evening. Again, Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. As Bob likes to put it, it is definitely the place to be.
You can tell the mailman not to call. I ain't coming home until the fall. And again, I might not get back home at all. Lulu's back in town, yeah.
Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital. This is Backroom Politics on Blog Talk Radio, live every Tuesday here. You can join the conversation at 877-662-3713. Again, that number is toll-free, 877-662-3713. We're going to change gears a little bit right now. We're going to talk about the impending confirmation hearing for former Senator Chuck Hagel as he goes to try and be confirmed as our new Secretary of Defense. Lots of money being spent to either support or, in many cases, put up an argument against Chuck Hagel. Some of them from some various groups. But there's no question, you cannot turn a TV on here in Washington, D.C. and not see a Chuck Hagel ad. Bob Hines, I'm going to start with you. Why is Chuck Hagel such a lightning rod on both sides?
Well, I think that he has his view. He's a Vietnam veteran.
From the Republican side, why is he a lightning rod?
Well, he's a lightning rod because his experiences in the Vietnam War have given him a set of views that are not necessarily in line with the more traditional Republican, some of the traditional conservative Republican views. He is a twice wounded and given awards for his service in the country. He has, but he has made some people angry, more the conservative branch of the Republican Party in both the Senate and the House. And I think he's made some folks mad, and I think he's, and while I personally don't think those issues are would disqualify him, I think he's going to have a pretty hard time. It's going to be a very active hearing, and it won't be a short one.
Congressman, now, why is he such a lightning rod for the Democrats?
Because he's impure.
Why is he impure?
He is not a pure conservative, and he is not a pure liberal. Hence, the purest conservatives don't like him, and the purest liberals don't like him. He's a man who thinks for himself, and he pops up in various places on the political spectrum with attitudes that are not usually found there on that yardstick. And that's just bound to set off both extremes of both parties.
But when Alan Moore, when you look at Chuck Hagel, you've worked with Chuck Hagel as a senator. There's no question he has the background and the practical knowledge to serve as a legitimate Secretary of Defense. But a lot of people are bringing up some ancillary issues, his temper. They're bringing up anti-gay remarks. It seems that almost there's a definitive campaign by both Democrats and Republicans to knock Chuck Hagel down. What's the story on that? Is there reality to this?
Well, this is an odd one. I think you got to start, though, with the fact that Chuck Hagel suffers from something that a lot of elected officials suffer from, and that is
an ego,
arrogance, and a lack of humility, and they tick people off. And Chuck was very good at that, at turning on his colleagues, scolding them in public, and when you make enemies in a sort of a public vicious way among people you think are your friends, people remember. So there's an undercurrent of that floats around out there. From some of the Democrats, there is resentment that one of the cherished plum of the cabinet positions in this new administration is going to a Republican, but there's no obvious political benefit to that. So there's a little bit of resentment. We've seen that happen before. With regard to his background, skills, and preparation, that's where we should be focusing. I don't think it's such a slam dunk that he's got the perfect experience for this massive undertaking, this extraordinary job in government that's complicated, that's political, that requires lots of judgment and time and boring meetings and so on. Having said that, he's got one thing that matters the most. The president likes him. The president likes his point of view. They share a point of view. They are friends. The president wants him. That will be the key to why he ultimately gets confirmed, which I think will happen.
Carl Tugin.
You know, one of the reasons why the Republicans don't like him, and maybe some Democrats, although one of the senators who counts votes said, Democratic senators that counts votes said he hasn't found one person who's going to vote against him, but was his vote on the Iraq War. Republicans took off on him at the time and are still smarting over that vote. He's a veteran. He helps veterans organizations. I remember hearing an ad where they said, go get the veterans organizations to write against Hagel. But that's not going to happen because the veterans organizations like him and like what he's done. He has some views. I think he's, because of Vietnam and because of some of these other wars that have been fought, he might be very hesitant to get America into another conflict.
Congressman Al.
You know, as Alan was laying out what a lot of the Republicans had against him, you could have thought he was talking about John McCain. As a temper, he tells off, and yet they ran him for president. Having tempers, let's see, one of the great hidden tempers of all it was Edmund Muskie, who could completely melt down
and yet he was very popular in running for things. I think you can nitpick. You're not going to find the perfect temperament, the perfect intellect, the perfect background, and people on the right and the left who are looking for perfection are not going to find it, so they might as well shut up for this guy.
Alan Moore.
I'm reminded when Trent Lott was forced under pressure to sort of step aside from being the Republican leader after saying some unfortunate remarks where he meant well in complimenting Strom Thurmond, and suddenly Lott finds himself in a position after a couple of weeks of having to step aside of all things, and a senior Republican at the time said privately, "It shows what can happen to you when you don't have many friends in the U.S. Senate." And I'm reminded of that with Hagel. It's not just temper and it's not just popping off, but, you know, he burned a bunch of bridges with people. I'm not saying that makes him a bad person or unqualified, but you haven't seen a lot of Republicans saying, "This is my best friend. We worked side by side on issue after issue after issue. And that's why I'm standing with him." With regard to the reference to Iraq, my recollection is Hagel voted for the war in Iraq, and then he turned on it, and it was the turning and the public turning and the way he did it again that broke a bunch of china that also concerned people.
But Bob Hines, you know, we look at Chuck Hagel. One of the claims against the former senator is the fact that he is looking at, and part of his agenda would be shutting down the entire nuclear program at DOD. You've had several senators come up and say basically this is a dangerous aspect. Senators including Mark Pryor, Mary Landrieu, Mark Udall, Kay Hagan, all saying that this is a dangerous path and he would make America weaker. Is there a foundation to that?
I haven't got the faintest idea. I mean, whether it is true or not, that I think he doesn't like the program. Whether it would be a damaging thing or not, I'm not qualified to say. I don't know.
The question is, where does the president stand on those things? The defense secretary is not going to unilaterally do any of those things.
Yeah, exactly.
Unless he's got the support of the president. And I do not think that the president is inclined in those directions. At the present time, anyway.
But when we look at it, though, I mean, they went back to a 2012 report that he did, according to our friends at Yahoo News, a 2012 report they did with an organization called Global Zero that called for an 80% reduction of U.S. nuclear weapons and an elimination of all nuclear-armed ballistic missiles. The reality is that he never came out and said, in fact, hey, just shut down the entire nuclear defense program. But this is not the first item that we're seeing millions of dollars being spent to go against Chuck Hagel. Does the fact that they're spending that much money, Congressman Al, against Chuck Hagel, is that a sign that there's going to be pressure going to the Hill to not nominate or not confirm Chuck?
When you say they are spending that money, who? The nuclear industry?
Well, you've got in the military. You've got people that are spending it. The HUS, the military industrial complex, are saying that we can't have that. You've got gay and lesbian organizations that some are calling into question: are they legitimate organizations? In fact, one source out of NBC says that it's actually an organization funded by Republicans. There's a lot of money being spent on advertising against Chuck Hagel. I can't remember in my time in D.C. that I've seen such an ad campaign for canceling out a confirmation, especially for something like Secretary of Defense.
Well, I suppose it goes back to Eisenhower's warning about the military-industrial complex. yes, I expect that a lot of money would come in from those people who find it to their economic benefit to spend a lot of money on defense.
Bob Hines, is the fact that he sits on the board of Chevron, does that mean that possibly we're going to see going back to petrochemical politics when we look at the defense sector?
Look, I think the opponents
who don't want to see him confirmed will find anything they can to bring up. Legitimate, that's a legitimate way you do business in on hearings. He'll have to ask, hopefully he'll have some friends, and I'm sure the president will do everything he can. But the fact of the matter is, if you can find something to say he's unqualified because, whatever the because is, you'll use it.
But
and I have
Congressman Al,
I have always believed that a president should have a lot of leeway in appointing the people that he wants to run, help him run the government. And I think in the last 20 years, we've narrowed that, both parties have just narrowed that down and go after whoever is appointed, and I think that's bad policy.
Alan Moore.
I agree with Al on that. On the one hand, there ought to be a lot of deference to what the president wants, particularly for cabinet appointees. Not judicial appointees are different because they're life appointments, but cabinet members serve at the pleasure of the president with the confirmation by the Senate. Having said that, the Senate is not just a bunch of potted plants who are just there to say fine, or we wouldn't even have a process of confirmation. We do see some troubling trends here. When people are spending a few million dollars, and that's what we're talking about,
yeah.
It's not tens of millions, hundreds of millions, because
it's millions.
It's millions, and it's all right here in D.C. They're not trying to generate grassroots objections. They're all trying to do it here in D.C. I think it's a colossal waste of money on the one hand, and also just really unfortunate sort of dirt in the air that we don't need. I hope that it fails, not because I think he's the perfect candidate, but because I think this trend would be horrible. I hope this effort fails and that people stop spending huge amounts of money here in D.C. trying to trash nominees for cabinet posts.
Congressman Al, you agree with that? You're clapping. That must be a good sign.
So
is Bob Hines.
I think that's a first.
That is a first. He's clapping at something you said.
You misinterpreted it. It's my imitation of a trained seal.
No, you're a former congressman.
I'll take it.
Yeah, no kidding. Let's be realistic, though. I mean, you have to admit, though, that when you talk about a nomination for Secretary of Defense, you're talking about our person, the commander-in-chief of our military forces, under the president, obviously. The president's obviously the total commander-in-chief.
Thank you.
I got that. But when you look at the policy, the operational commander of military forces, you're talking about our front line of national security and national defense. Does it make sense that this should be politicized and that the scrutiny should be placed on somebody, whether it's Chuck Hagel, whether it's a Leon Panetta or whoever? Bob Hines.
I think it's perfectly reasonable to do it. Hopefully, if you are a supporter of the nominee who's being criticized, it'll be cleared up. If they find something that disqualifies him, that's a separate question. But the fact of the matter is, the president wants him. He wants him to be a part and a major part of his defense and his military security and foreign policy team. He has a right to have him there unless there is a disqualifying factor, which may or may not appear. I don't know. It doesn't seem to be.
But does the disqualifying factor include his past voting history, his past voting records, his statements on policy?
It's a part of the debate, and it's a legitimate part of the debate. It'll be debated in the hearing, no doubt about it.
Carl Tuven.
He has tried to go back, and he has tried to apologize to the people that he offended, number one. Number two, you know, military policy isn't just set up with the Secretary of Defense. He's got a national security team. He's got foreign policy advisors in the White House. His new chief of staff was a main foreign policy advisor to him when he was a senator and also in the White House. So it's, you know, there's a lot of people that go in, as we all know, a lot of people that go in the mix of making up a decision on foreign policy.
Alan Moore.
His voting record, his speeches, his statements, they're fair game, but we're not electing him here to be president. We're not electing him even to the Senate. We're saying, can you run the Defense Department? I got some questions, frankly, about his qualifications to take on that particular role. But those concerns are getting zero attention, and they tend not to matter very much. I will say that in the past, you know, usually we end up confirming, the Senate ends up confirming nominees, but I remember the case of a senator from Texas named John Tower, who was nominated by Ronald Reagan to be, what was it, George H.W. Bush, to be Secretary of Defense. And he failed. He failed because he was a sitting senator, and senators who knew him had concerns about temperament and some drinking issues. And ultimately, it was an ugly, messy, challenging, difficult matter. But people felt very strongly about it, and he ended up not getting confirmed. Doesn't happen very often, but it sometimes does. And these issues matter. But the fact of the matter is, there's a commander in chief who's calling the shots. That man's name is Barack Obama. And if Hagel can't get on board with the decisions Obama stakes out, then he wouldn't be nominated, and he won't survive.
But in legitimate defense of that, though, the Secretary of Defense, particularly in Barack Obama's case, is somebody that he leans very heavily on for guidance in forming defense and national security policy. Alan Moore?
He may or may not. It just depends on who's in that role.
Well, you look at Bill Gates. You look at Leon Panetta.
Actually, I'd look at Bob Gates. But
Bob Gates. I'm sorry, Bob Gates.
But back.
Bill Gates had a Microsoft.
It was me.
Yeah. Bob Gates. I'm using an Apple computer. So,
you know, Bob Gates had, you know, was a carryover from the previous administration when Obama was just getting underway. Leon Panetta was a trusted advisor. But Obama's increasingly comfortable with these issues himself, and he's increasingly comfortable with his national security team, his interactions with the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and others. So he's got a much better base of knowledge now than he did. He won't just rely on a new guy.
Carl Toobin.
Hagel has been an advisor to Barack Obama since before they went into the White House. They did some campaigning together when President Obama was running for president. He's been on certain security commissions in the White House in the first 2 years. So he's been right there at the time as probably an unpaid advisor.
But is this the beginning of a new trend, a scary trend, of seeing media wars being brought out for or against nominations by the White House for key cabinet positions, Congressman Allen?
Well, I think you've got a situation that has developed over recent years in which people go to the streets, i.e. to the media, on almost everything. So is it new? No. Is it new as applied to a cabinet officer? Yes. Is it good? No. What are you going to do about it?
Bob Hines.
Let's hope that we don't have too many of these. I think we've all said that the president has a right to pick the advisors he wants. He may make a wise decision. He may make a mistake. But it's the president's call. He's got a right to make that call. He won the election. But the reality is, you know, I suspect that there'll be a long, drawn-out hearing. It'll be a tough hearing. I think you'll probably be confirmed.
Carl Toobin.
Mr. Kristol is behind some of this, as are other right-wing people. And part of the thing that they're doing is they get to Hagel to get to Obama. They've lost the election. They want to throw a little mud here and there, and I think that's part of it.
Wait a minute. There's some notable Democrats that are coming out, and there's some media from Democrats that have been put out against Hagel as well, going against their head of party.
That doesn't make what Carl said wrong. It just means that the Democrats have a different and probably equally illegitimate reason.
I'm partisan. What can I tell you?
Congressman Al, he gets confirmed?
Yes.
Carl Toobin?
Yes.
Bob Hines?
Yes.
Alan Moore?
Yep.
Well, there it is, kids. Hey, we're going to take a quick break. It is happy hour here at Shelley's Back Room, which means that we're going to order our drinks and cigars. We'll be back in about 3 minutes, When we come back, we're going to talk international policy and the Hillary and Barack love fest. When we come back here on Backroom Politics, stay with us.
Happy Hour on Backroom Politics is sponsored by Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., America's premier cigar tavern. Stay with us as the roundtable continues after we order our drinks, order our cigars, and get ready for the second hour of Backroom Politics. Stay with us. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Especially now with what's going on in Davos, where you have David Cameron talking about Europe being out-competed, out-invested, and out-innovated, they're going to be looking to the U.S. as a leader and helping them stimulate growth and jobs. And also in Asia, with the rising influence of China, it's going to be important for him to carry on Hillary Clinton's role in managing an effective U.S.-China partnership.
Is somebody like John Kerry, the secretary now-to-be, is he somebody that can get behind organizations such as NATO, the UN, the EU, etc.?
Yes, I think he can. He's been involved in foreign affairs issues for many, many years. He's developed a tremendous amount of respect among world leaders, and he's worked very closely with Hillary Clinton, who, as we know, has done very well on the international front.
Bob Hines, we saw the love fest that was the confirmation hearing for Senator John Kerry, now the confirmed senator, or the new confirmed Secretary of State for Barack Obama. That love fest was short-lived. This was just a matter of formality. Would you agree?
Sure. I mean, there is no way that he was not going to be easily confirmed. He's liked by his colleagues. He's had a lot of foreign policy experience. The president wants him.
But Congressman Al, I mean, Senator Kerry was not his first choice. They are still fighting the issue regarding Susan Rice, the UN ambassador, who was his original nominee, who withdrew her nomination after huge political outfall from Benghazi. Can the president get as much, whether it's loyalty support from John Kerry, as he would from his first nominee, Susan Rice?
Oh, I think so. Kerry wanted this very badly. Everybody says he can do a good job. I don't know all the reasons that the president preferred the woman.
Susan Rice.
This is not a weak or bad second choice. And I think Kerry knows that. The president knows it. Probably Susan Rice knows it.
Alan Moore.
In fairness to John Kerry, we don't know that he was the second choice. Susan Rice was never the nominee. She was under consideration. We know that the president thought very highly of her.
Fair enough.
We know that she was under consideration to be the nominee. We know that in the course of the process, when there was a bunch of negative stuff about her from various key members of the Senate, she said she withdrew her name from consideration. She didn't withdraw her nomination. She never had a nomination. It's unfair to John Kerry to say he was the second choice. He may very well have been the first choice. There's a political concern about John Kerry in that he's a sitting senator, and it's not clear in Massachusetts who will follow him. And Scott Brown, who ran a powerful runner-up race against Elizabeth Warren, is now leading in all the polls to be the next senator. And that's always a consideration when you're taking somebody out of the Senate, is who replaces him and what happens to the numbers.
But let's not
be unfair to John Kerry.
Fair enough, and I would concede that. But Ralph Winnie, when we look at John Kerry being the former chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, is that a concern in the international community? He's too political. He's coming from a very charged political background as a former presidential nominee as well.
I think it only will serve to help him, because he'll bring a wealth of experience in terms of dealing with international leaders.
And some gravitas.
Right, some gravitas. A lot of it's going to depend on the ability to engage in relationship building, a degree of nation building. He's going to have to continue Hillary Clinton's policy of direct engagement with China, focusing on promoting a rules-based international system as opposed to the selective stakeholder that Hillary Clinton was worried about as Secretary of State. So it'll be important for him to bring a lot of clout in pushing for everyone playing by the same rules, a sort of a new world order, so to speak. But
when you talk about China, Ralph, Senator Kerry, in his experience, is he one that's going to try and bridge the economic influence between the U.S. and China, or are we going to see some of the same issues? Is he going to be supportive of the foreign investment security rules and regulations?
I think it's going to remain to be seen. I think he's going to try and continue along the lines of what Hillary Clinton has done. But there are obviously a lot of challenging issues related to trade and national security affecting the U.S.-China relations. And it's only going to get even more complicated as you have more and more Chinese companies trying to come over here to do business with Americans and trying to work within the system to set up their businesses and also deal with the immigration issue and the visas, which are sometimes granted or not granted arbitrarily.
But when we talk about China, we talk about, you know, we've seen companies like Huawei. Yeah. Huawei is now considering possibly pulling out of the U.S. market. You've got companies like A123, which we had a guest on a couple of weeks ago, talking about the investment of a Chinese venture capital firm trying to buy this battery company out of New England. That's going to be a challenge. It's going to be on Kerry's table to be in the beginning.
Right, because Chinese play by a different set of rules than the U.S. does. I mean, the Chinese have tried to integrate into the world community, and they've done it rather imperfectly, but not at the rate that everyone would expect or demand. The whole issue of the rules that state-owned enterprises play by versus private enterprises in China becomes very problematic once Chinese companies come into the U.S. and have to deal with actually setting up a company and dealing with technology issues, which is so important.
Carl Toobin, you had a comment.
Yes, I have a comment. Number one, we have to remember that Senator Kerry's parents were Foreign Service officers, his father, and they traveled all over the world with the father. Also, with regard to Massachusetts, there was a thing on TV last night that said that Scott Brown might run for Senate, and he might be looking at the governor's race.
Interesting aspect. Interesting.
I was going to say another dynamic is going to be the role that Theresa Hines Carey is going to play. She comes, as we know, from a very wealthy family, has done a lot of charitable work overseas, is engaged on an international level, and a lot of times the spouse. I mean, if they're well liked and respected, that's only going to serve to help John Kerry in many ways.
Alan Moore, what are some of the challenges that you see coming up quickly for Senator Kerry as he takes over the folks at Foggy Bottom?
Well, in addition to all of the world crises that he has been involved in as Chairman of Foreign Relations and is now newly involved in as an important arm of the president, the aftermath of the Arab Spring, Syria, Libya, Mali, the China relationship, the Russia relationship, the Middle East tinderbox that continues. There will be many, many things around the world to keep him occupied. The same issues he's been working on, but now he's got a different vantage point from which to pay attention.
Ralph Winnie, is John Kerry viewed well by the folks in Beijing?
It's hard to say. I think they do have a degree of respect for him. It's going to be interesting to see how he engages with them.
But is he going to have the credibility to actively and proactively work with the Chinese government?
Yes, I think so. At this point, it's going to, again, a lot of it is going to depend on which fights he chooses to pick with them, and in terms of creating opportunities for American and Chinese companies really to work together, because so much of what China is about is creating a better quality of life for their people, and they view the U.S. as an opportunity for their citizens to come over and to set up businesses, make money, and learn from the capitalist system that has been the hallmark of our society.
What about Moscow?
Well, the Russians are very angry with the U.S., and as you know, they have the ban on U.S. adoption of Russian children. This is after the quote, Russian reset. And that's going to be very challenging right now because you've got the Russians and the Chinese traditional allies, but under Kissinger, he moved the Chinese away from the Russians into the camp, more or less, of the U.S. And the challenge for Kerry is going to be to make sure that the U.S. and the China have better relations than China and Russia.
Is that possible?
I think it is, because the Chinese have always looked up to and respected the Americans. They remember how we helped them in their fight against the Japanese during World War II. We never occupied them as some of the European powers did. We never looked down on them.
Right.
The Russians, years ago, as part of their alliance with the Chinese, they in effect demanded the Chinese to pay the Russians for foreign aid that was given to them. And the Chinese were charged a very high interest rate, and the Chinese have never forgotten it because they had to pay it back as a matter of national pride, but they've always held that against the Russians, who were in effect forcing this aid on them and then telling them they had to pay it back at a high interest rate within a relatively short period of time. So this is an opportunity for the U.S. to work closely with China, at the same time safeguarding our national security interests.
Alan Moore, when we look at Russia in particular, I mean, we look at the strained relationship between Moscow and Washington right now. We look at a more nationalistic government inside of Moscow, led by, yet again, Vladimir Putin. Is Russia a threat, and is John Kerry ready to call them out as being a threat to the U.S.?
When we say threat, you know, they can get under our skin, and we get under their skin, and it becomes a sideshow that diverts time, attention, and energy, which is really unfortunate. But this guy Putin is a powerful egomaniac who is a true challenge for us to deal with.
That's there are some in the international community that call him Stalin-esque.
Well, you know, I'm not smart enough to know whether that's a fair charge, but he's a tough customer, and he diverts a lot of attention and energy. Having said that, you know, John Kerry is going to be treading carefully. He doesn't want to get the president into messes that the president doesn't want to get into. So, you know, at the same time, he's not a potted plant either. He's going to be out there. He's going to be going to meetings. He's going to be representing the United States around the world. But I think he's going to be a cautious guy because of his experience.
And yeah, I don't think he's
Congressman going to, now.
I don't think he's going to be another John Foster Dulles by any matter of means in his relationships with Russia. Things have changed in the world since John Foster Dulles, and there's some question whether he did the right thing, but I don't think that Kerry will be following in that tradition at all.
But Bob Hines, John Kerry, no question, has the respect of his colleagues in the Senate. He's got the respect of obviously and the support of the administration for being this. But let's be honest, he's got big shoes to fill in following a dynamic force in international policy for the U.S. in Hillary Clinton. Hillary was very, very proactive. Traveled the most out of any Secretary of State in the history of this country. I mean, she made this a traveling roadshow to get the U.S. back in the good graces of the international community. Can John Kerry still do that or continue that mission?
I think he can. Remind yourself, he probably traveled to as many countries as any chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee in the Senate has ever done. He's been all over the world. He knows most of the leaders of any country we have to deal with reasonably well. He's been in there, he's been with them, he's been in their neighborhood, he's been talking to them, he's spent time, he understands the problems that they deal with as well as the ones we're trying to solve. And I think he's got a pretty good background, and I think he'll do a good job. Now, he isn't going to have the, how would you put it? The reality is, Hillary Clinton was a real force. Whether he will be as strong a force in that sense, I don't know. But I do know this. He's got a lot of energy. He wants to be good at what he does, and I think he'll be a good Secretary of State.
Congressman Al, you had a comment.
No, I really didn't. I absolutely agree with that. I was waving my hand around.
Arms akimbo, if you will.
Arms akimbo.
Very good. Very good. But, you know, let's talk about Hillary Clinton for a second. Hillary Clinton, over the weekend, did an interview with Steve Croft from 60 Minutes in a joint interview with President Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. It was, for lack of a better word, a love fest. First of all, let's talk about that dynamic for a second. There's no question that the relationship has grown close between Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton was a trusted advisor on international affairs. Is that a gap that needs to be filled, or can anybody fill that gap in the president's eyes, Alan Moore?
Well, the president knows John Kerry. They served on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee together. They've dealt with each other for the last 4 years. Because remember, John Kerry replaced Joe Biden as chairman of that committee. And I think that in terms of a working relationship, they've probably got about as good a one as President Obama has with any other colleague, simply because he didn't know that many colleagues all that well. In the second 2 years he was of his 4 years in the Senate, he was traveling the country to run for president. Now, in terms of Hillary Clinton, I'm a fan of Hillary Clinton, but I have trouble of kind of elevating her status to some iconic, amazing person. She was a great friend of America around the world at a time where we needed somebody to put a different face on. She was a loyal and important follower of Obama. I think she did some great things at the State Department, particularly in elevating the status of women. But when you start looking around the world at particular crises and who she did and so on, well, it'll be interesting to hear some of the people talk about what her true legacy is, because there aren't big victories. It was just a change. The world likes to have somebody they've heard of and know about. Here's Hillary Clinton. Everybody in the world knew who she was. John Kerry, a lot of people know who he is. He was a presidential candidate after all. So the world sort of likes that. But I'm not knocking Hillary Clinton by challenging exactly what her great grand legacy is. But I think it's important to remember that, you know, that anything that happened in the world, and we've had plenty of problems in the last 4 years, really were from Obama, not from Hillary.
Congressman Al.
Well, I would share with Alan a concern that the media and the Democrats and even some Republicans, I think, have leapt in and praised her so highly that there's a question of whether history is going to bear all that out. I don't think she's going to come out looking bad. But whether she's going to become, you know, in the minds of people, the best Secretary of State since John Hay or whoever. Fact, I'm sure she's
not. You're before my time now, Alan. It's like John Foster Dulles. It's like, what?
Now I know where to go. I got to use old names.
Old names. There's also Simpson and Hall.
Oh, good Lord. Okay. But I mean, the big question that everybody's asking about, in fact, our friends at CNN were just talking about this, is what is Hillary Clinton's legacy going to be? Ralph Winnie, I'll go to you. On the international front, what is her legacy in the international front?
Someone that was very hands-on, very engaging, that people looked up to and respected. She said what she meant. But again, there are a lot of problems in the world community that have no finite solution to them. And is your legacy someone that will solve all these problems, or is it someone that can bring people together and do the right policies of engagement?
Congressman Al.
I think her legacy may be that she kind of repaired America's relationships with a lot of people where there was a lot of bruising going on during the Bush administration. And that means that she's leaving Kerry in a much better position than she was in when she took over, vis-a-vis our allies, some of our enemies even. And that's probably the overall thing that she'll be remembered for.
Carl Tubin.
First of all, there are a few things. First of all, the joint appearance doesn't surprise me at all. When you look and you see what Hillary Clinton has done, and we've all talked about it, in repairing our image in the world over the past 4 years, number one. Number two, she was also an advisor to the president on other matters, not just foreign policy. And he appreciates that very, very much. You also have the fact that Hillary Clinton's husband, who's a force unto himself, came in last summer, gave that wonderful speech, we think, at the Democratic National Convention, and literally, possibly, saved Obama's chances of a second term. So there are a lot of things that the president feels grateful for, and I think that was the genesis of this joint appearance, not to puff her up and not to this and not to that, but just to talk about different things and give her her due. And also, I didn't know this until this morning, that Obama supporters have written checks to give Hillary Clinton $250,000 to pay off her 2008 campaign funds or campaign debts. So all of this is appreciation of the president for Hillary. Now, there are a lot of people who said, where was Joe Biden on Sunday night? Oh, he was on the ceiling, you know.
Well, let's talk about that for a second. I mean, there are critics of the 60 Minutes interview that say that it was basically a love fest, that the president and Hillary Clinton just gave away a great opportunity to get strong messages out to both the international community and the U.S. electorate in, you know, putting out a footprint forward, in putting out a message that the American people can grab onto on any issue. Bob Hines, is that accurate?
I think that the two of them just had a wonderful time together. I think they were enjoying themselves. I think they were happy with each other. She is retiring. He feels, the president rightly feels, that she did one hell of a good job. I think she feels herself that she performed well and did what she needed to do. You know, it's okay.
But,
big deal.
Yeah, but
2 weeks from now, who will care?
Well, hopefully we'll care on this show, because what Americans are waiting for are direct messaging, direct policy stances, direct accurate positioning from the administration on all things political. As Alan pointed out earlier, we've got situations across the globe. We've got you've got Iran and North Korea lighting off rockets like bottle rockets, like it's a 4th of July.
And beginning Friday or tomorrow, whenever it is, we have a new Secretary of State who will be dealing with those problems. And Ms. Clinton will be back home relaxing a little bit and getting another little bit more rest.
Grab winning.
One of the interesting dynamics is what's going on in Mali with the French battling those Islamic fundamentalists. How is the U.S. Role going to be in that conflict? What is John Kerry's next move going to be? Because the French are not going to be able to sustain that conflict for much longer. And it'll be interesting to see who comes out on top, because that's the next battleground is in Africa among these Islamic fundamentalists.
Congressman Al.
When I came into the green room before the program, there were only Republicans here, and they were talking about what a disgusting love fest this was.
I think one of the terms used was political porn.
Yes, and I think that's correct. I think you used it.
I may have.
I didn't see the program, but as it was described, I couldn't figure out why they did it at all. And I would be very interested to know who initiated it. Did the White House pick up the phone and call, 60 Minutes and said, we want to do this?
Well, there are several sources around Washington that are saying that this was propagated by the administration and that they forced the hand on, not forced the hand, but they were the ones who pushed the issue with produces in 60 minutes.
If that's the case, I do not understand the logic of it. I think it was a great, opportunity to talk more seriously. Just a second, Alan. If 60 Minutes did it, then I really wonder what they were thinking of, because you cannot put two people like that together without having some serious things to talk about that don't end up little love fests. I mean, I always call it how does it feel to be Queen of the May? What do you talk to a beauty queen about? I mean, it's bound to be puerile and stupid. And so whoever is responsible for it should be spanked.
Okay, capital punishment from Congressman Al. Alan Moore.
Yeah, I agree with Al here. I mean, I didn't find it offensive. I found it odd that these two would be on there. And my guess is that Steve Croft, who has done several interviews with Obama likes him because he doesn't push him too hard, but he's still a legitimate journalist, and it's a good audience. Probably has a standing invitation. Mr. President, we want you anytime you want. At which point, the White House can say, "Hey, we got an idea. Somebody thought, well, let's do something nice for Hillary. She's been good to us, and it was good for Obama to have somebody like Hillary on his team rather than in the Senate." The losing candidate for the nomination possibly making life difficult. There were some political reasons as well as substantive reasons. There was no guarantee that Hillary Clinton would do a great job. Now, I do feel a need to say that I'm guessing some of the women and men to supporters of Hillary would be a little surprised at Carl's suggestions that one of her great accomplishments was to be married to Bill Clinton, who bailed out the president last year at the convention.
Carl Thuman will give you equal time. Oh, Carl Thuman, you're going to take that from him, Carl?
He's stunned into silence.
My goodness, Carl.
Never stunned into silence.
Oh, my God. But the reality
is a fact that President Clinton helped President Obama be reelected. Not only did he speak at the convention, he went and spoke in the field, campaigned all over the country, and really has to be given credit for what he did. And I think that his whole dynamic there. Also, forget about that interview. Hillary's being interviewed by the BBC. CBS was the Sunday night. ABC,
CNN today.
CNN, all of it. In the next few days, and then Friday, I believe she speaks at before the Foreign Affairs Council in New York.
And I don't believe there are very many people who, after 4 years, think that she is some kind of weak little pawn of Bill Clinton. So I think that doesn't play.
Ralph Winning.
And I think it was important for her to sort of define and create her own identity separate and apart from Bill Clinton. That was something that was very, very important.
Yeah, but she created an identity not separate from Barack Obama.
Right. That's the interesting conundrum.
I think that's
right
for Bill Clinton to worry about.
I don't know where you're going with that, Al, but we're going to leave that alone, Al.
You know something that we don't?
No, and don't give him the opportunity either. Al Moore, you're shaking your head.
Oh, no. I'm going to stand by my original comment. We're talking about Hillary Clinton and what her legacy was. It has nothing to do with her husband, who we've now heard about twice. And
that was important.
I say that what she did was a great service. One thing that John Kerry is going to inherit, and nobody's going to be talking about this, so you might as well hear it from me. She created a whole bunch of new little branches in the State Department. New special assistants for this, new special assistants for that. She's not the first
Center for International Peace, that big monstrosity.
No, she didn't do that. That was done in the Congress. But she created a lot of special assistance shifts and so on. And she's not the first secretary who's done that. But somebody needs to come in and clean up some of that crap because it just lives on and makes it harder and harder to operate that department. Again, this is internal management stuff, but that's the one negative, I think, that's a legacy that's probably going to linger.
She's expanded the bureaucracy at Foggy Bottom.
She created a bunch of very senior people who report to her, and Carrie's going to have to figure out, do I want to keep those offices? Do I want to keep any of those people? And that kind of stuff takes time and effort and energy. People tend not to spend time on it, but it is a problem.
Okay, well, we're coming up on the break. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about the GOP turnaround on the debt limit. Surprising turn of events happening last week. We'll talk about that in a little bit. Ralph, stay with us. We're going to be back in about 4 minutes. This is Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Stay with us.
You know, here on Backroom Politics, you hear us order drinks during happy hour, the second hour of Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio. But what you don't understand is the quality of the drink that we're getting here at Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Backroom Politics premier sponsor. Hey, you got Dave Hammerly and the bar crew there at Shelley's Backroom that really know how to pour a drink. Whether it's something simple like my on-air Jack Daniels on the rocks with a splash of water, or whether it's something elaborate like what has to be the best martini in the District of Columbia for Congressman Al Swift. Wine selection, scotch selection that will blow your mind. They've got Highland scotches. They've got Isle of Skye scotches, blended, single malt. Anything you want. Port wines to go with that great cigar from the great humidor. Down here at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Come on down, have a drink, and make some new friends. Or heck, just come on down and listen to Backroom Politics on Tuesdays.
need to go there. Yeah. Hey, we're back here live at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. It's our last segment. Hey, we're going to talk a little bit about...
Where do we not need to go to? That sounds like it might be interesting.
Do you want to talk about the A123 issue with the Chinese investment?
I have no idea.
Battery company in New England? Don't worry about it, Al. We'll call you off the air. Hey,
That sounds like it would require a fact.
You spent half an hour listening to it.
Anyway, here's the funny thing about this. We're actually going to talk about something that in my lifetime, this year so far, I didn't think would happen. We saw a reversal by the GOP on the debt ceiling, on the fiscal cliff, and a myriad of other issues. We're starting to see... God, dare I say, movement out of the GOP in working together with the Democratic administration. Bob Hines, fill us in a little bit.
Well, what happened was the Republicans in the House, who have been the strongest proponents of we've got to cut entitlements and we've got to get the Democrats to come to the table on that subject, decided that it was foolish to use the debt ceiling is that issue, because I think they realized that if we went we did not continue to provide the ability of the government to pay its bills, the Republicans and the House particularly would have been the ones who the president would have appropriately said, you know, did a dumb thing. I think they did a very good, they developed a very good policy by saying, look, we're going to pass over, we're going to give a 90 days extension of the debt ceiling. Now, that means that there are, in between now and the time that the debt ceiling comes up again, which I think would be in April sometime, there are going to be two opportunities for the Republicans to take a look at pushing the Democrats into discussions of what they, in, with respect to entitlements, they are willing to do. That's the first one, is the sequester, which comes up in about 3 weeks, 3.5 weeks. And the second one will be the continuing resolution, which is, unless it is a new one is adopted, the government has to close down because they can't spend any money. There's no more authority to do anything. So this is a very good thing the Republicans have done. They have finally figured out a way, I think, to at least get the Democrats willing to talk. The nice thing about the program that the Republicans have gotten the Democrats to agree to is the Senate is going to have to write a budget. The Senate hasn't written a budget in, 380 days, Alan?
At least.
It's over 3 years.
It's a few years.
It's almost 4 years. And it will be interesting to see what they put in their budget with respect to entitlements and taxes increases, because they'll do both. At least we know they'll do tax increases. So it's an interesting requirement that they have set their Democrats to do. Now, we'll see what happens, but it's probably the smartest thing the Republicans have done in several years.
Oh, there it is. But hold on. Alan, fact check, Bob.
It wasn't that big a deal.
Two weeks ago. Why wasn't it a big deal?
2 weeks ago on this very program... One of us said, debt limits, let minute, you know, it, this...
And when you say one of us, you mean you?
Oh, yeah, I guess it was me. thank you for pointing that out. I said...
Fact check.
Look. This is not the crisis that the Republicans want. The sequester is real.
Yeah.
The budget, the continuing resolution is real. The debt limit is kind of a phony battle, and I think what they'll do is kick it down the road to get to the sequester and the debt limit first. And a couple of days later, the Republicans went off and had a meeting and came back, and lo and behold, did what? I wasn't the first person to suggest this. It's just that it seemed like that was the easy route, not the courageous route, not the sea change. It was like... Let's put that around behind the sequester, the real spending decisions that are in front of us. That's where the rubber meets the road.
Congressman Al,
I think it may be the first intelligent thing that they have done in several years. And that leads me to believe that it wasn't the right wing, it wasn't the Tea Party. And I'm going to ask Bob this. Do you think this means that John Boehner, who is a very bright man and whom I have a lot of respect and even some affection, does it mean that he is beginning to get control of his conference?
Bob Hines, answer that.
My answer to that is severalfold. Number one, I think that the Tea Party is beginning to recognize that they don't control the world, or at least the Congress. I think they've begun to realize that they have to find ways to challenge the Democrats in ways that actually challenge the Democrats. And it's taken them a while to learn that. Just as you will remember, Al, when the back in, as Alan will too, back in 74 when that the Watergate group came in, we had a bunch of Democrats who couldn't find the washroom, just like the Tea Party hasn't been able to find the washroom. They're now beginning, I think, to realize that the leadership really understands how to get things done if they'll just let them bring them an idea. And this time, the Tea Party, I think, said, hey, you guys, that's a great idea.
Yeah, but Bob, just as we're getting to this point where we're starting to possibly a slight break in the log jam, we still have 86 freshmen that came into the 113th Congress, many of them Republicans, many of them Tea Party backed, that are still coming in with that Tea Party flavor,
yeah.
And they're still coming in saying, no, 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 no.
And there's still a whole bunch of Tea Party people who voted against it on the floor of the House. But there's also some Tea Party people who started to realize it. Now, you know, it's going to be a progression, because once it starts to work, it's going to be easier for the Tea Party people to say, hey, look, this is working. This is a better way to do it. And that's the problem that we have had if you're a Republican in the House, where the leadership has never had a majority of the Tea Party people who thought they knew what they were doing, i.e. the leadership. Now I think the Tea Party people recognized that they were going to get blown out of the water if they went with the debt ceiling, as Alan said. He was exactly right. They figured out, what the hell are we going to do? The leadership came up and said, look, this is an idea. And they got, and the Tea Party, enough of the Tea Party people said, you're right. They finally are beginning to recognize that the way to win is to pick your spots and recognize where you have leverage, not just where you can make a big noise.
Okay, but let's look at it from a practicality standpoint. You're the Tea Party. I don't know more. Is this the breakdown of the Tea Party as we know it, do you think?
Not yet.
Like I said, this wasn't that hard. I'll tell you what was hard, and it was before this. It was how to cut at the end of the year the tax deal. That was hard. That was the one that was hard for Boehner, because he let that pass through the Senate, through the House with a minority of his own party. That was tough. That was hard. That was a big deal. This one,
that's a credit to Speaker Boehner.
Well, I think it is a credit to Speaker Boehner, but he was in a position where he didn't have a lot of options either, because he's not going to be Speaker very long if his new way to get stuff through the House is to have a minority of his own people join a majority of Democrats. His willingness to do it once showed an enormous amount of courage, but you can't do that very much. This one was a lot easier, because you were just kicking the one thing down the road. The hard stuff is in front of us. It's the sequester and it's the continuing resolution. That's real money.
Bob Hines.
I want to emphasize what Alan said. You can't live, as Speaker, you cannot live by doing what he did with respect at the end of the year on the taxes. You can't. He did a very gutsy thing, because there are members of the Republican leadership in the House who would not be happy with something like that, and clearly a bunch of the Tea Party people.
Yeah.
But he was prepared to do what had to be done. Now, he can't do that very often, but the fact that he didn't need to, because the next time it looked like we were going to do something that might be not smart, he found a way to pull enough Tea Party along to put a program in place that is going to cause the Democrats some problems when the Senate majority Democratic Party tries to write a budget that deals with entitlement changes, which is going to give them one hell of a problem.
Congressman Al.
How do you get things done in Congress? I've often used this analogy, but something that freshmen cannot know. You've got to be there to learn it. And it's not brilliant. It's a special thing. It's like plumbing. This is the analogy I have used in the past. It doesn't take a genius to learn how to plumb your house.
Al, Oklahoma elected one congressman. Oh, that's Al. I'm sorry.
But you do have when your toilet is backing up into your kitchen sink, you need somebody who knows how to fix that. John Boehner is a really good plumber. And if the Tea Party has figured out, oh, there are a few things we've got to learn about how you get things done around here, Congress will be a very different place, a better place.
But Congressman Al, you know, we've heard several folks inside the Beltway talk about this. If Tip O'Neill had been Speaker, Tip O'Neill was a very straightforward, very effective Speaker. You did not go against the will of the Speaker. As head of the party in the House, he would have had committee assignments yanked. If Tom DeLay, if members of his own party had gone against Tom DeLay would have dropped a hammer the size of Cleveland on their head. Is this a sign of, is Boehner starting to look at that as a model, or is Boehner just trying to deal with the cards he was dealt?
I can't tell you what's in Boehner's mind, but now let me add a few facts here with regard to Tip O'Neill. We had a whole class of very conservative Democrats. They look what they call the
Blue Dogs.
Blue Dogs. Well, the Nugs before the Blue Dogs. And there were, it was a situation, I always said, that was very unusual. The Republicans had the majority in the House, and the Democrats had all the chairmanships. Because we had that many Democrats voting regularly with the Republicans, and Tip O'Neill couldn't control it. And if he was just going to pull everybody off of their committee assignments and whatever, it would have been such a massive thing that it would have caused rebellion. So Tip had to work his way through that very subtly, and as you suggested, he was a great speaker. He knew how to do it, but it was not easy. And he had a minority of his own party that was giving him fits for two years.
You know, remind yourself that six weeks ago, when the Republicans were reorganizing, as the Democrats were in December in the House, the Speaker removed a number of freshman Tea Party people from their committee assignments, particularly their most important assignments. You know, they removed several people from Ways and Means and things, you know, major committees. And he did that in order, you know, he didn't do it wholesale, but he did it just enough to send a message, I ain't going to put up with it anymore. And it helped a lot when he was trying to solve the problem of getting off the debt ceiling and moving over to the new policy.
And Tip, right or wrongly, didn't do that.
But I want to go back to something that Alan said, because I think it needs to be pointed out and highlighted. What Speaker Boehner did showed a tremendous amount of political courage in doing what he did. Is that type of courage and what Boehner did, is that something that members of the House, and I'm going to go to you, Congressman Allen, is that something that the members of the House can take notice of and maybe learn from that?
They should.
Will they?
If you're going to ask if Congress is going to do something intelligent, it's always smartest to bet they won't. But
civility. Good job, Al.
Well,
he said in a very civil way.
That's true.
Yeah, I did. But what was the original question?
Oh, forget it, Al. Alan Moore, help me out here.
Yeah. Well, what they learned was, remember what led Boehner to that position. He had an idea
that he needed all of his people to support because it had zero Democratic support on taxes. He came up short. It was embarrassing to him. And suddenly, he didn't have very many cards. And that's what led to the Senate, Mitch McConnell and Joe Biden, to cut the deal on taxes. And I think what his own guys learned was, wow, maybe we should have listened to him before, not putting him into this position where a minority of us Republicans had to support something with a big majority of Democrats. That's the lesson. Not that, gee, yeah, this is the way we want our guy to operate in the future. No, it's not the way they want to operate. But that they helped put him into that position where he was, it forced his hand in that way.
Carl Tubin.
I think Speaker Boehner showed a lot of courage and showed leadership. And I think that he could have only picked up respect from some of his Tea Party people and other Republicans who kind of, you know, what is this? But he got something done, and I think he picked up a lot of respect for that, and maybe that's why it was easy to turn some of these folks around to do what they're doing.
Congressman Al.
And what I lost in my mind when I was talking was to say that what Congress needs at every level is more courage. This whole idea that you got to run scared, and I mean run for re-election, scared all the time, is, first of all, it's not true. I found that anything I did in the first year of my term was not remembered by the time I got to the election. So you've got a little freedom in there to move. And when in fact the fate of the country is resting on this, then something I said in the last program, Jim Wright, did you come here to get elected or did you come here to govern? And there needs to be more of that, and Boehner may, by example and effectiveness, have begun to teach some of his people the truth of that.
Bob Hines, last word.
Touch what Alan said earlier about the Republicans with respect to the debt ceiling, you know, it was a minority of Republicans voting. I think that, as much as anything else, I don't want to talk about inside information, but I think as much as anything else, I believe that that vote made the Tea Party realize that they couldn't run the universe. They needed to negotiate better. They needed to let the leadership find ways to do things. And I think as much as anything else, the recognition that they couldn't stop something they had disagreed with, and the speaker would not let the whole thing fall apart, was very important, both for John Boehner saying, we're going to do this because we have to, and the Republican Tea Party realized they could be isolated and could lose their authority if they didn't be careful.
Bob, in 20 seconds, is this the beginning of the breakup of the logjam on the Hill?
That may be too optimistic a view, but at least the Tea Party has learned something very important.
Is it a glimmer of hope?
Yes, indeed.
Very good. Very good. Hey, it's time for my favorite part of the show. It's Tell Me a Story, where we talk about the news, innuendo, and buzz going around Washington, D.C. Once in a while, we scoop the other media outlets, but let's go around the table. We've got 7 minutes, so make them quick. Congressman Al, do you have a story?
No.
Don't worry about it. Carl Tubin, tell me a story.
A little known fact, maybe it's more widely known, and I think, was that Mitch McConnell is down to 20% in voting. Mitch McConnell's down to 20% of reelectability, and there could be a Tea Party challenge if he stays that low.
Okay. Bob Hines, tell me a story. I know you're going to talk about...
Within the next 6 months, the president will approve the trans...
The XL pipeline.
The XL pipeline.
Very good. Very good. Alan Moore, tell me a story.
Okay. Mitch McConnell and Harry Reid cut a deal on the filibuster. I think it's an excellent deal, worthy of our further conversation down the road. The president has a new chief of staff, Dennis McDonough, a protege of Tom Daschle, and a terrific guy who's been with him for 8 years. I'm very optimistic about that. There was a little bizarre business in a newspaper interview with the president this week. He said, oh, we go shooting all the time. meaning up at Camp David shooting skeet. It had the ring of authenticity of Beyonce singing the Star Spangled Banner at the inauguration.
Ralph Winnie, tell me a story.
Okay. Lance Armstrong. I look for him to be removed from his foundation. He will file for bankruptcy in about 6 to 8 months to avoid all the lawsuits that are coming his way.
Interesting. one last story real quick. Some sad news for those of us who know him. Secretary of Transportation Ray LaHood, a Republican, former congressman from the great state of Illinois, has announced his departure from the administration as Secretary of Transportation. Big shoes to fill. He said great stuff for the transportation infrastructure. Had a hard job selling the stimulus package and everything like that. A truly great guy. Good politician. Solid Secretary of Transportation. He's going to be missed.
Who from time to time, when his schedule would permit it, could be found at Shelley's.
Very true. A big fan of Shelley's Back Room, by the way. His choice of cigars sometimes are questionable, but we can give him the good stuff every once in a while. Bob Hines, you're close to Ray LaHood. Know him well. He's going to be a lost fixture from the administration and a solid voice.
He'll be a loss. He's probably the best Secretary of Transportation we've had in a long time, if not ever. He's going to stay in Washington. He's not going back to Illinois to run for office. He's going to stay here, and I suspect he'll enjoy his life here and be a lot less stressful.
And hopefully come to Shelley's once in a
Let's
while.
Let's hope
we'll
so.
Try and get him on the show.
Well, not only will we try, we'll succeed.
I hope so. That'd be good. Anyway, on behalf of Congressman Al Swift, Carl Tuven, Bob Hines, Alan Moore, our international affairs expert, Ralph Winnie, I'm your moderator, Justin Russell. We will be back next week, live from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Bob?
Isn't it obvious? This is the place to be.
It is now. Woo! Folks, we'll see you next week. Have a good day. Bye-bye.